Welcome to It's Our Money with Ellen Brown, a look behind the curtain at the hidden world of monetary control, control that determines whether economies succeed and who benefits. Ellen Brown is a lawyer, scholar, and best-selling author of Web of Debt and is president of the Public Banking Institute. Later in the program, we'll take a look at new developments in the public banking movement. But now, here's Ellen.
Thanks. Well, I have a raging cold today, but I'm going to do my best. An item in the news that seems to have stirred up a lot of interest is the fact that Belgium just bought $141 billion worth of U.S. Treasury bonds. That's nearly a third of Belgium's GDP, and Belgium is not running a surplus. So the question is, where did Belgium get the money? That's what Paul Craig Roberts wanted to know, along with his co-author Dave Kranzler, when they wrote an article on May 12th called "The Fed is the Great Deceiver." They said that money must have come from the Federal Reserve itself, a reasonable presumption. And the implications of that are, first of all, that the Fed is not actually tapering off on its quantitative easing, as Janet Yellen is purporting to be doing. And second of all, that some large holder of U.S. debt must be dumping their treasuries. So the interesting thing about all this is the implications of that and whether this is a great disaster, whether the end is near for the American empire. This is what Paul and Dave have to say. They conclude that the Fed believed that it could not buy the bonds outright, but needed to disguise its purchase by laundering it through Belgium, suggests that the Fed is concerned that the world is losing confidence in the dollar. Well, that would be true. If the dollar lost substantial value, the dollar would lose its reserve currency status. Washington would not be able to issue new debt or new dollars in order to pay its bills. Now, that's the part I would question. They continue. Its wars and hundreds of overseas military bases could not be financed. The withdrawal from unsustainable empire would begin. Catherine Austin Fitz says that that view is optimistic, the idea that American empire is about to crumble. She points to something like $40 trillion worth of hardware that was funded through black operations and is floating around the earth, and the fact that the U.S. military is not going to release its grip on things just because of a little quantitative easing. And another expert is Martin Armstrong, who says that the dollar will remain the reserve currency because there's really no viable alternative. Everybody's got it. It's convenient. And the other currencies just aren't up to that level. What's interesting to me is whether it's a big disaster that we're funding our debt through quantitative easing through our own central bank. I think that's where they should, how they should fund the federal debt. It's not like this is a new idea. It was done by Australia, New Zealand, Canada, France, lots of other countries before the 1970s. That was the way you did it. Your central bank was there to create credit that you would borrow and then spend it on the things that the government needed. And ideally, these would be self-funding loans, and they would generate some sort of income that would then pay off the loans. And that worked out very well for those countries. Canada, for example, used this credit generated through their own central bank in order to build roadways, seaways, and to fund their excellent healthcare program. And Australia did the same, roadways, seaways, and they funded their participation in World War One without borrowing from the Bank of England. Quite an accomplishment, which later got them in trouble. I've written all about this in my book, The Public Bank Solution, my latest book. As Mariner Eccles pointed out in the 1940s, he was head of the Federal Reserve. He said that if we had no debt, we would have no money supply. We actually need a debt because all of our money is created by debt. except for coins, which are a minuscule part of the money supply. It used to be in colonial times, of course, that the government created the money, but that's no longer true. Now banks create it when they make loans. So your choice is to borrow from private banks, which will charge you a pretty penny for interest, or to borrow from your own bank, which will lend to you interest-free. My guest today is someone who also has different ideas about our looming debt and whether perhaps we should be printing more dollars rather than less.
Mark Pasch is a certified financial planner and registered investment advisor with over 40 years' experience in the financial services industry. Money Magazine called him one of the top financial planners in America. He is the founder and CEO of the Center for Progressive Economics and the author of a book called E equals MCF, The Theory of Economic Relativity. He has long been active in politics and was a congressional candidate in 1996. He says he is a full member of the 1%ers, but he has a solution for helping to restore financial equality to the 99%. Greetings, Mark. Great to talk to you.
Thanks for having me.
So I want to get to your solutions, which sound most intriguing. But first, you want to tell us a little bit about your work and your latest projects?
Well, basically what we're trying to do is educate people on the proper macroeconomics of the world, what the world should be. Basically, now we have a debate of 20th century macroeconomics versus 19th century macroeconomics. And 19th century laissez-faire, of course, is wrong. And the 20th century FDR is not complete, a little hazy for most people. And we're working on trying to give them the correct solutions to that.
So you're moving into the 21st, though. So what's the 21st?
Yeah, we have to create a 21st century, which is totally, it's going to be totally different than laissez-faire. And it has to deal with, of course, money.
You spoke at our Public Banking Institute conference in Philadelphia. And one thing that impressed me was that you were explaining that the federal debt is not really a debt. That if it were a debt, it would have to be paid off at some point. And we haven't paid it off since 1835. So could you?
Yeah, that is correct. Basically, what over time is that the central banks of the world, or the U.S. Federal Reserve here in the basically create money with a computer, pushing a computer button, and retire the debt. And of course, another name for this is quantitative easing, but that's when they purchase a lot of other different things too. But that's the main function. And so the deficit spending is a way of getting money into the economy when the banks aren't lending, which they're not now.
Was just speaking about the, well, it was an article by Paul Craig Roberts saying that the Federal Reserve is buying back additional federal securities secretly through laundering them through Belgium. So they're not actually tapering. They're actually buying more debt than we know, and they're being secretive about it so people won't panic. But it seems to me that buying up our own debt is the best way to do it. I mean, it's the cheapest way to fund a debt. And like you say, it's not really a debt. It's really our money supply, that there is no money in our system except for debt. All debt is money. It's credit and debt, or, you know, two sides
right,
of the balance.
Right. Well, what happens is that the Federal Reserve's mandate, of course, is to protect the banking system. So half our over half our national debt, and there is sitting in the central banks, the commercial banks, insurance companies, and the Social Security Trust Fund as reserves. It is not out and circulating in the economy, and so you don't. That's why you don't see any excess inflation out there. So all this stuff is, if they're printing money, it depends on who they're printing money. So if China is selling their debt, they're going to get money. And what they do with this money is purchase our goods or come over here and purchase our investment properties. And you're starting to see that flow now, where China is coming in like Japan did in the late 80s and start buying properties because there's nothing else for them to do with the money.
But even that, it seems to me, of course, we don't want to sell off all our ports and airports and things like that. But But in general, to have some of the dollars come back to the United States seems to me like a good thing, because we have a lack of demand. That's what's preventing businesses from hiring. They don't have the customers. So you need the customers first, and then they'll go out and hire and get
them. Well, the reason we don't have any money is because the way of issuing currency in the circulation, somebody has to go into debt, either me as an individual or a company, or the government. And since it's only the government, people are reluctant to go into debt because they have to pay expensive debt service. And so this is why you don't see enough money in circulation, because people don't want to get in debt. It's even worse in Japan. People don't want to borrow at all. And so you see a lack of money in circulation. And of course, that's what drives the economy. It's like the blood in a human being. When you don't have it, our economy goes down.
Well, so for that reason, it seems like we almost have to start it with the government. In other words, the government has to go out there and commission some projects like infrastructure. We know our infrastructure is going from...
Right. Well, the way it's structured now is the government has to, which is, not really the correct way, is the government has to do some what they call deficit spending. And the deficit spending, they borrow some of it and then eventually is monetized, turned into money. And that's how they get it into the system. And then the right side of the aisle thinks that's debt. And so it restricts, they try to restrict even that. And so it's not a very efficient way of getting money into the system.
Right.
By having to create some form of so-called debt, either private or public.
Right. And we think that we can't afford all these things like infrastructure, and yet we have workers out of work that would love to get in there and build this infrastructure. The resources are there. The only thing we don't have is the money. So.
Yeah, that's correct, because their assumption is money is scarce. And if it's in the if it's in the hands of a private a commercial banking system, it is very scarce and it is very expensive, but there's nowhere where it's written anywhere where it has to be there. And so in reality, it costs nothing to create a dollar, and a very tiny amount to distribute it. And until we realize that, all we have to watch out for is what I call excess inflation. And we can put it out there in three different modes. We can actually do direct currency issue, and we can also do it in equity and distribute it through debt. So there are many ways we can distribute it.
What do you mean in equity?
Well, what you can do is I don't want to get too much into that because it's a smaller avenue, is the government puts money out by so-called borrowing, okay, both privately and publicly. Well, and there's debt service there. Well, they can do it in some sort of joint venture and get an equity return. You don't have to get an interest rate return. There's a lot of negatives to paying interest. And, of course, and what happens is you see what's happening is the financial sector starts crowding out the rest of the sectors because they have all the money, because they're charging an interest rate for money that really doesn't cost them anything to make. And, of course, then all the money flows into Wall Street. We'll call it Wall Street. And that's why you see this concentration. And one of the major reasons for inequality, not the only reason, but one of the major reasons for it.
Right. And by my calculations, if we, the people, owned the banks, in other words, if we had a public banking system, we could actually not have to pay taxes. In other words, they did that in Pennsylvania, the colony of Pennsylvania in Benjamin Franklin's time, where the government actually owned a bank and it issued the money that was lent through the bank and they didn't pay taxes. But we could, by my numbers, we could actually do the same thing today. The last time I looked, the banks were lending they got $700 billion in interest.
It's basically the same thing where you're creating and issuing money through debt. But being that it's a public, you can do public things with it. You have some diversity. It's usually cheaper in cost because Wall Street doesn't have to take its piece. So it's a definite a part of the solution. The other aspect of the public banking is that it educates the local politicians on monetary policy. Most locals and many nationals don't even know what it is. And so that's going to be a big help also from a political standpoint.
Right. I've heard two treasurers, or one treasurer and one somebody at the treasurer's office. One was in Washington State and one was in California. Say that we don't have the money to have our own bank because we don't have the money to lend, that we have to use our money for our own budget, which that's not actually how banking works. You don't spend your depositors' money. The money is still there. So anyway, it seems to me that politicians aren't necessarily the most savvy economists. I mean, I'm running for treasurer myself, so.
And that's one of our missions at the center here is to educate our leaders, along with the general public, that on the correct monetary system and what they're really running and what's happening. Why you see the right lose, the left lose, and the right lose, and the left lose, and then the reason is the general public. You get elected, and then you're not really in charge of the economy, and it goes kapooey. And then you're out of office because the monetary system has far more control of the economy than the fiscal tax and spend system.
Say that again. Sorry.
The monetary system is far more important economically to the economy than the fiscal or tax and spend system. And our leaders in Congress are not in control of the monetary system at all. And so their only control is to the fiscal system, and the fiscal system can help rescue a collapse like it just did and in 29 and 33, really. But really, they're not in control, and so they lose their election because people vote on the economy. And if it's a bad economy, you're out. They want to see a growing, healthy economy, and they're not in control of that alternative, which is the monetary system.
So by monetary,
and that's why
you see
the back and forth election and you see the rise of the Tea Party. They don't know what's going on, and they know our leaders aren't doing anything because they're not in control. They gave it away in 1913.
Right. So by monetary system, you mean the ability to actually create the money?
Yeah, create the money and distribute it out there in a well-diversified manner. So it goes to a lot of people, and they start spending and investing, and the economy, grows.
I saw you speaking with Nomi Prince on the fight over inequality, the 1% versus the rest of America. Can you give us a little taste of what that's about?
Well, basically what's happening is, and Pitney's new book proves it, but we've all known all along that pure laissez-faire capitalism, of course, all the money goes to the top, and actually it's the top one-tenth of 1% more than the 1%. And so how do you reverse that? And we have about 12 or 13 points to do it. As long as you understand the monetary system, it's easy to do that. And, of course, what is inequality? I'm not overly concerned with a 99.8% difference between the bottom and the half. What I want to make sure is that all people, especially starting in the United States, has their basic nutrition, shelter, health care, education covered and taken care of, so they have their basic needs covered. Then there's less pressure on wages. And all this microeconomic talk of equating labor. And the main reason is they equate labor as a cost, but actually labor is basically also your customers, clients, and consumers. That's as brief as I can give it.
Well, I'm interested. I mean, so what are your 13 points? I mean, how would you bring this about?
Well, basically what I would do is forget about the safety net. I'm talking about basically everybody except maybe the 1%ers, is I'd give everybody food stamps, okay? I'd give everybody basic free health care, free education from age 2 to grade 14. I would give them a stipend to cover their shelter and other needs, where actually I would directly issue the money. And they would have their basics covered. And all we have to do is to make sure that we don't create excess inflation by doing it. Okay? So monitoring inflation is very, very important, and it's the only statistic we really have to monitor. And then the bottom people and all the workers and everybody in the countries, basics are covered. Then if they want anything extra, then they can go work. And you're not going to solve inequality from the top the people that make extra money versus the people at the bottom, because we're not really equal. You know, how are you going to be equal to the people that founded Google or Bill Gates? Well, you're not going to be, okay? They might be more talented. They might be luckier. Lucky is a big factor. But if we cover the basics and then you go from there, you'll create a real healthy economy, and it'll be good for business. It'll increase their customers and reduce their wage pressures on their wages because the government. And, in fact, The Economist magazine came out with that they should be supplementing some of these wages, which, of course, was shocking when they came out with that editorial also. I was really surprised because they're a little bit on the conservative
side. Sort of basic social credit or basic FDR's economic bill of rights. So we just print the money. I agree that would work, but you know what the objection we're going to get is that it is inflationary. So how do you...
That's the only thing that you have to worry about. So you gradually implement it so we don't have an inflationary. Also, if you increase taxes a little bit, I hate to get in that argument because that's what everybody says, especially on the top 1%, you could actually cut taxes. If you have the monetary system doing it, then when you increase taxes on a certain amount, that reduces the money supply. So you control inflation by controlling the amount of money you put out there and also controlling the tax rate or the taxes that you collect. And the federal collection of taxes actually is an anti-inflationary move. You're actually removing money from the thing. So if you have a proper tax system, which we talk about a little bit, and tax the real guys, okay, the wealthy guys, there's no reason why we can't, the billionaires especially, then that will control inflation. But that's the key statistics. You've got to make sure you don't go into excess inflation. And that will be the key motivator. So you won't do it all at once overnight. You can start doing it now, but you can't do it without the correct monetary system.
But people say, well, we have inflation now, that they say there's no inflation, but you can tell at the grocery store or you can tell at the gas pump that there is inflation. So how do you determine inflation?
That's an excellent question. You have to have the Commerce Department have various formulas, okay? And I have 13 points to keep inflation in check. But you can issue a lot of money if you do it properly and have the proper tax system before any excess inflation. You have to have 1% to 2% inflation because you don't want 1% or 2% deflation. And if you diversify the distribution system, Commerce Department watch it, you can control it if that's your task, which it should be.
Yeah, it does seem to me the fact that the Federal Reserve has been doing all this quantitative easing, and people are kind of blasé about it. Like, nobody's freaking out and saying, well, look at all the trillions that they're adding. I mean, we know it's really only landing on bank balance sheets, and that's why it's not
right.
Being inflationary. But the fact that people are getting used to the idea, I did see an article, I forget where it was, maybe it was The Economist, but it was about how we should just be printing the money in order to do foreign aid. That first of all, that money is going to go into foreign countries, so it's not going to be inflating our money supply. And it's what we do in foreign aid right now is very small. So if you doubled that, you're still not going to do much in the way of dollars. But it would be a huge boon to those countries because they rely on that foreign aid. But
I'm a little bit negative on actually giving the cash. Yes, it's not very. It's a small part of the budget. Or overly giving cash, because when you go to those other countries, most of them are extremely corrupt, and the money ends up in the hands. If I can get some goods and services over there to help them, I think it's better for our economy and better for their economy more than direct cash. Also, when you put direct cash out of the country, it reflects although we're not talking about a lot when you're talking about foreign policy, but when you put cash out in wars out of the country, it affects the exchange rate, and that is a big factor in inflation because it affects the currency markets and the deficit, the trade deficit, and that is a factor in inflation, especially in smaller nations. So you have to be a little careful there, but again, it's a small part of the budget and wouldn't be a significant thing anyway.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was just the idea that they're talking about that, and nobody's shocked by this idea because now the Fed has kind of broken the ice and said, look, we can print lots of money and no big deal.
Yeah.
So let's do it. If they can do it to save the banks, why can't we do it to save the workers and the students and the homeowners and all those.
Oh, absolutely. Well, in fact, when they bailed out, instead of bailing out the banks, if they bailed out every mortgage holder, I mean everyone eventually, with a low-cost mortgage, all that money would have ended up in the banks anyway, indirectly. It's all circulation. And you would have bailed out all the homeowners, and the economy would have been healthy because their payments would have been lower. The banks would have had their money, so they would be happy, and it would be a win-win situation. When you just bail out the banks, it's not a win-win situation. It's only win for the banks. And this way, and that's what they did wrong in the bailout. And the lack of understanding of money is the reason that happened. The Federal Reserve is not a government agency. It's neither federal nor a reserve, okay? And the way you know that is because the people working for the Federal Reserve are not government employees. So they're out to make money for their banking system and their bankers and not to overly protect the people that borrow the money.
Yeah, that's what I was actually at, or I introduced Nomi. She's introducing you, I know, at Eileen's next event, but I introduced her at her event a couple of weeks ago, and that's what her book is all about.
Her book is really I just finished most of it. It's really a history of this banking system, but it doesn't really get into the functional operation of it. And I think we have to, you know, human beings are human beings. They fail in operations. And so any type of monetary system has to be so powerful, has to have a lot of checks and balances and a lot of diversity, especially in the distribution. And then when there's a massive mistake, like in 08, it doesn't take down the whole system. We just go and correct it because we make a lot of mistakes as human beings, and you want to create the system that can handle those mistakes. Same thing with inflation.
Then there's this question of the Chinese and the Russians are talking about dealing in their own currencies bilaterally and not using the dollar. So many people are saying that when there's a flight from the dollar as the reserve currency, that the dollar will collapse and we'll have hyperinflation. But I don't actually believe that, but I just wonder what your view is. I've read other people, like Catherine Austin Fitz says that's actually the optimistic view. She said, no, we're so protected or so tight militarily globally that that won't happen. And I've read other people say there's no other alternative to the dollar. And then there's this whole thing about the Triffin dilemma, that you don't even want to be the reserve currency because all the other countries then want your dollars, so you wind up in trade deficit all the time. So I just wonder what your view was on.
Well, I think that's really in a very, very extreme happening or condition if that happens. And so it's a nice debate, but it probably won't happen. And one of the major reasons it won't happen is because they have to buy oil in dollars.
Yeah,
and so I don't think that. With OPEC and us, who are the larger oil producers, and then there's Russia. So it's a reserve currency basically because we have this banking system that needs some sort of reserves and this trading system that does. Well, if you eliminate that system, then you don't even need a reserve currency. It would be the currency markets that would dictate the value of your own currency, as they do now to a degree.
Right. I think that's what Keynes said at the Bretton Woods when they were negotiating, when they made the dollar interchangeable with gold as the reserve currency. His argument was that you don't want an individual currency to be the reserve currency, that you should have some sort of, I think his idea was a basket of currencies.
What we're trying to do is get rid of this whole banking or central banking reserve currency system. Because you don't need to create dollars with some sort of reserve. And if you have a debt or credit dollar creation process, which is actually the creation and the distribution only through debt, you want to have this reserve. But we want to get rid of all of it. You don't really need it because all it does is it collapses. I mean, if you look at the last 100 years, we've had 16 recessions, Great Recession and the Great Depression, not counting our inflationary cycles, in the last 100 years. And so that's not a good track record for the Federal Reserve in this debt because it's unsustainable. It doesn't, when you issue money only through debt, you don't issue the interest. And so it becomes a conflict of trying to pay it back. And they knew this in, even in biblical times, where they knew that, the money changers charged an interest, that eventually all the money changers would have all the money and there would be no money in the economy. So this is a kind of basic money history. And so this is what we're doing now with the creation of money only through debt. And we have to eliminate it in order to eventually, it's going to be eliminated, probably not in our lifetimes, but we'll give it a shot.
I agree. It's an unsustainable system. And what we've done for the last several hundred years is have wave after wave of bubble and then collapse of the bubble. And
not even a good system for the bankers because they have to write off their debt or they get bailed out by the taxpayers or the government prints up money. Many times they have to, especially in foreign loans, they have to write off their debt. And so it's not a good system for the bankers either. We can create a good system for them too.
Right. We had bailout and now we're going to have bail in. And it seems to me that when they start bailing in depositors' money, that's when we're liable to see things change. Right now, people are kind of indifferent. You know, they're still watching their soap operas. And
correct. They'll say if we have for the next crisis for change, well, we'll see what happens. The Internet is a very helpful tool in instituting change now. And as it broadens, it's going to be very helpful.
Yeah, I agree. I think that's what's saved us from sort of capture by the mass media that are controlled by big business and big banks. So I don't know if you know the answer to this, but I've heard of other types of accounting. William Krem of Comer in Canada says that the government should be doing accrual accounting, that we count this huge debt on one side of the balance sheet, and then you ignore the other side of the balance sheet, write it down to a dollar or something.
Yeah, what we're doing there is we're looking at the government as a business, which I call microeconomics, instead of looking at the government as macroeconomics. And do we want to apply the same accounting standards to our government, who can create money, as you do a profitable business? A business wants to make money. The government, really, from an economic standpoint, wants to have a well-paid and healthy citizenship. Okay, it's totally two different goals, and you apply the accounting methods of microeconomics to the government, and it's really inappropriate because really the only statistic that counts is inflation, not GDP, is inflation. If you're getting enough money out there to take stimulate the economy and take care of everybody, why, I don't have to make a profit. I don't have to show assets. I just have to worry about inflation and a quality economy. I don't have to have this bookkeeping like I have to do for a business. And so there's a lot of debate on that. There's some people who think that the government should own all the land like Israel, and there should be no property, you know, the actual land. You can own the things on the land and should be leased. There's a lot of philosophies in that arena. We're trying to make the next step that's a little more practical. But I don't think the government has to have capital assets. What you want to do is look like a business, and I don't think it has to look like a business. As long as it controls that inflation rate and takes care of its population and makes sure we have a healthy economy, I don't think it has to have a microeconomic accounting.
Yeah, no, I totally agree, and it's great to hear somebody else with that view.
This is the conflict in which you hear is because people think on a micro basis instead of a macro basis, and they're two different things. So as a businessman, I really don't want to overpay my labor. But as a businessman, I want to have a lot of well-paid customers and clients coming into my practice or my business or my store. And so they're really at odds of each other. And that's why you need labor unions, minimum wages, and we really shouldn't compete on basic wages because those are the people that come in and shop in our stores. And so there's a conflict there.
Right.
And but most people think on a micro basis, and you don't want to do that on a macro basis.
As Henry Ford said, he had to pay them.
Absolutely.
They could buy his Ford.
He was right in 1907, and then Ford. Yeah, and then Ford became a terrible union. Anti-union company. But he was right in 1907. I want him to buy my car. It's so simple.
Well, if you want
for having me.
A website and some other data where people can find you or get more information about you.
Yeah, my website is www.cpe.us.com. That's cpe.us.com. And you can, of course, email me and ask any questions or read over the website. We have a very shortened monetary section, only 10 pages or so. They should read that so they understand the monetary system. Read my article on inequality and solutions. It's just a couple pages. I try to write it for everybody rather than the lengthy 200 or 700 page books, and so people will read it. And so that'll be on our blog. So a lot of good articles are there. Also, which I didn't mention, is Baxter is here. And Baxter is a robot that is replacing humans on the assembly line, and it costs $22,000, and they can work right next to humans, which are the two differences. And so that's the big thing that's coming.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All righty. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. Okay. Goodbye.
Bye.
That was Mark Pasch, the founder and CEO of the Center for Progressive Economics and author of E equals MCF, The Theory of Economic Relativity. If you'd like to learn more about what they're up to, his website, once again, is cpe.us.com.
The dollar is up to a lot of activity around the world, not all of it good. And today we're going to be having a conversation with Ellen and Mike Krause, columnist and observer of the dollar realm, to take a look at what kind of dynamics are at play now in the reserve currency status of the dollar and the way that reserve currency is being played by some of our loyal opposition.
Both of you have written about our declining profile of the American dollar. And Ellen, earlier in the show, you talked about the perceived laundering of Fed money through Belgium as a way of propping up the dollar. And Mike, you wrote about the not so visible involvement of Wall Street in the Libyan uprising. And now to see also that the BRIC countries are really getting fortified by the political juggling of what Russia is doing with China around fuel, and that the BRIC countries are looking at also including Argentina. So that's a growing group that is interested in creating a new currency, perhaps a new currency, a real competitor for the U.S. dollar.
The BRICS alone are 40% of the world's population. Not only that, our good friend the Saudis are busy putting up a new refinery to ship oil direct to our good friends the Chinese, and they're going to trade in something other than dollars. I mean, the world's moving away from dollars because, you know, they're tired of being bullied by the United States.
Yeah, it's my opinion, though, that that's not going to hurt us. It might hurt our bankers, but I don't think that's going to hurt the American people. There's that thing called the Triffin dilemma, where you really don't want to be the reserve currency because you will always wind up in trade deficit because everybody wants your dollars. And nobody is big enough. No currency is big enough to replace the dollar anytime soon, so I've read. And so
I think that's a true statement, that last one.
Say that again?
I think that's a true statement, the last one, that there are no currencies big enough to take the place of the dollar and facilitate world commerce. There aren't enough other, you know, rubles, won out there. But Paul Craig Roberts has written pretty convincingly that if other nations start to trade for other than dollars, we got a bunch of dollars sitting around, and they got dollars, no place to go. So if they can't use their dollars for oil, what do they do with them? They dump them. And that's a problem because that makes the dollar worthless. And since we import everything, that makes all imports more expensive. That's a problem, I think. That's what I think.
Well, theoretically, that would make the interest rate go up on our bonds, but I just don't think it will because our Federal Reserve will buy the bonds interest-free. I mean, it certainly would drive Greece's bonds up or, you know, any of those European countries that are in trouble. But I think we have a secret weapon, which is our Federal Reserve. Not that I'm necessarily defending the Fed, but to me, the best way we can fund our debt is through our own central bank. Why do we need to borrow from the Chinese or other big countries?
Well, in point of fact, the biggest holder of American dollars isn't the Chinese or Russian, it's the American people.
Right.
We hold those bills.
Yeah.
We hold most of them, and the Treasury has some, and pension funds have some, and individuals have some, and it's not correct that, you know, our debt is held by China. That's not true. We hold the majority of our own debt still. But you know, we're not an exporter. And so people can't use their dollars to buy our product because we don't have any product, you know, beyond some amount of energy and some commodities like wheat, for example, and financial products. You know, our economy is now 60% is driven by the financial sector. They don't make anything real that people can buy with their dollars. So they got all those dollars out there. They're going to find a home and get dumped probably. And when they get dumped, that's going to put pressure, a downward pressure on the value of the dollar. So I think it's a real concern that imported goods can become a whole lot more expensive as the dollar loses value, if it does. And if that happens, you know, already difficult circumstances become more difficult for millions of Americans. I think that's a problem.
And the projection of American hegemony and the Western hegemony through its banking institutions, the IMF and the World Bank, are going to be challenged when the BRICS get together in July in Brazil to talk about creating a development bank that will definitely be a competitor for a worldwide developer for American dollars.
Well, that's something that needs to be happening. That's what Libya was doing, by the way. You know, Gaddafi was putting his money, oil money, and into not only his own project in Libya for the benefit of ordinary Libyans, but funding at lower cost interest development throughout the African continent. One was a satellite. You know, international phone calls out of Africa have been very expensive for a long time. I know. I lived there for 2 years because only one satellite that services that, it's European. So Gaddafi was funding the development of a competing satellite to handle the phone calls out of Africa to the rest of the world. And of course, you know, the Europeans who own that satellite didn't like that because they made tons of money on expensive phone calls out of Africa. And I'll say this again, I lived there 2 years. It cost a lot of money to call out of Africa to anywhere in the world because of the European monopoly on telecommunications, which Gaddafi was funding to break.
I lived there 3 years. We both lived there. Yeah, I was just reading about Libya, that things are falling apart as was predicted. So now they've become a hotbed of radicalism and terrorism, and they're liable to be invading. I mean, they're the home of terrorists that might invade Europe, and apparently the oil that they're shipping to Europe is much less than was being shipped before. And what I read, this is in Global Research, that NATO knew that when they joined the purge or the coup of Gaddafi, they knew that they were jeopardizing their own oil, and they did it anyway. So the question is, why? Why would they do that? It seems to me that they are marching to some bigger, more powerful drummer than their own economic interests even, and that would be the global international banking cartel, which did not want that Libyan model out there at all. Libya was printing its own money, funding its own development, like that waterworks that was brilliantly done. And they were attempting to spread that whole model throughout Africa so that all of Africa could break free of the banking system. And the one tenet of Islamic law is interest-free banking, that it's interest or usury is considered a sin and a crime in many places. So Gaddafi was doing that, doing basically interest-free loans, and that was a thing they did not want to see succeed, so they had to crush it. So not that, of course, we favor public banking, which would involve interest too, but my argument is we're talking about returning the interest to the people. So the real definition of usury was extorting profits without working, or pulling profits away from the people that worked for them.
It's worth pointing out that, you know, many states, if not most, had usury laws, and the interest rates that, for example, banks and credit card companies can charge now would be considered ungodly in much of the United States 30 years ago. But the federal Congress overruled state usury laws with the caps off interest. And that was, of course, because of the lobbying of the major banks. Let us think about it. Wall Street banks get their money at point something percent from the Fed. And what's the typical interest rate on a credit card these days? 18, 19, 20, 25? Who knows, depending on, you know, your situation, your credit rating. Well, they get their money at point something and lend it on credit cards at 25%. That's awfully nice work. But, you know, that was considered immoral in much of the country until the Congress overruled state usury laws and set a national standard, which is, of course, whatever they want to get away with, they can get away with. That's the standard now.
And, of course, our credit card companies, MasterCard and Visa, have both been very present in all over Europe and Russia as well. But now Russia is going to be charging them an exorbitant fee, which apparently Morgan Stanley says is going to be not allowing credit card processing through them to be profitable. Meanwhile, China has issued its own new pay program, and this stratagem that Putin has done seems to be really setting up a very interesting collaboration of not only monetary and geopolitical, geophysical interests, transportation and all, you know, and gas, and of course this new banking prospect of the BRICS. Seems to be like we're maybe be heading toward a new world, a bipolar financial world, whose central banks will have their own political realities and agendas, some of which will intersect with some of our own allies.
Mm-hmm. We need the Cold War. We actually need somebody to balance the system on the other side. Otherwise, our bankers and our military just running riot over the world. They need somebody who can stand up to them. So it's good for us, the people, it seems to me, to have somebody else who's strong out there.
Well, one of the things that's interesting about that, Ellen, I would just add, is that the Chinese have been building capital projects around the world, you know, really bringing, creating value in economies. While we've been spending our money propping up or sending out military forays all around the planet, which doesn't create any particular value, although it creates a lot of international debt.
Well, let's be clear, though. The Chinese aren't creating value for the people of Africa or Asia. They're creating value for themselves. The Chinese are mercantilists, basically. And I was there in Africa. I watched them get around. They move in, do deals for raw materials. They pull them out back to China, manufacture the goods back to where the raw materials came from. This is mercantilism. 18th century, 17th century mercantilism. So they're not, you know, the friend of mankind. That's not what the Chinese are up to. They're up to improving the lot of their own people, making money, of course, from a major financial interest, just like we are. You know, the Chinese are not so unlike us in that regard. So they're busy doing deals, if, for example, Afghanistan, while we're busy, you know, holding free and fair elections, we say, they're busy doing deals for raw material. And they're all over Africa doing deals for raw material. Those materials go back to China, manufacturing takes place, as it used to the United States, and the goods come back there for sale. So that's the Chinese mercantilists of the 18th century variety, and that's what they're doing. So I just appreciate we're not the world's model anymore, neither are the Chinese.
The difference between them and the IMF is that they don't impose austerity measures. I mean, they don't force the country that's in debt.
Oh, they don't care. As long as they get a good price, they don't care. As long as they get a good price for the raw materials and can sell their goods back to the country of origin of the raw materials, they're happy.
That's another case where they need a counterbalance to the IMF, which just comes in with these very onerous conditions for any sort of loan. And, of course, they wind up in debt because we tripped them into debt in the first place.
I suppose I'm going to say something that's pretty obvious, but you want to just get it validated. Is it really true that our financial interests are moving our politics into creating such an upset in other countries like Libya and Iraq and Afghanistan? I mean, is that really the essential frontier for American and Western banking interests, is just to interject themselves into global politics at every opportunity?
Yeah, it may be where Wall Street needs to interject in London, but there are 7,000 banks that are not Wall Street in London, and those are our local community banks, and we could create, I mean, the local banks certainly don't need that sort of aggressive policy. We could be like the Germans, where 70 or 80% of banking is all about supporting the local economy.
I think it's a vital perception, Ellen, actually. There was a Swedish guy who did an article about American banking a little while ago, and he said, curiously, that the United States actually has a robust local banking industry. Robust, those were his words. And he pointed to the, at the time, 7,200 community banks, now down to 6,200, last count by the American Bankers Association. Mm-hmm. So the local banking industry is getting squeezed. And this creates an even greater concentration of assets in the biggest banks, which aren't lending into the productive economy. I think I read that the New York Mellon, now just 31% of their business is lending, and the rest is the exotic stuff. So it's pretty clear that the once upon a time, it seems to me, that the banks supported American economy. Now it seems American economy supports the biggest banks. We've turned it upside down.
Right, and the small banks are supporting the biggest banks too, yeah. The one and only state that hasn't lost any banks since 2008 is North Dakota, and that's because their Bank of North Dakota supports their local banks.
Well, this is a very interesting aspect of the conversation about our money, to see what our money is doing around the world. And I want to thank you both for helping to expand the view. We need to check in with this periodically and see what our bankers and our money is up to outside of our boundaries. Thanks very much for joining us on this conversation today, Mike. And we'll talk again soon. The efforts to start public banks around the country are many and varied, and one of the most active areas is in the state of Pennsylvania, where on the western side of the state, an entire region, which was beset by manufacturing outsourcing and the demise of old industrial businesses, has been facing a variety of municipal financial challenges. Today we're going to be talking to one of the protagonists for creating new public banks in western Pennsylvania, John Leonard of the Pennsylvania Project. Welcome, John.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
It's great to have you. You live in the vicinity of Pittsburgh, and I'm just wondering if you could kind of give us some backdrop on how the public banking discussion came up in that environment.
Okay, I joined the public banking group about, I don't know, 2.5 years ago. And what I've done lately is I went around to my county first, and I checked out every single municipality, town, township, borough, whatever city, whatever you wanted to call the entity, and saw it themselves could create an economic development bank that would benefit that group of cities instead of going to the county first. I thought the county would have been a bit more difficult thing. And what I discovered is that it's impossible to do. We have some cities that are in Act 47, which they could never afford it. Most of the municipalities around here just don't have cash or could never come up with the kind of cash to create their own bank to benefit them. In Pennsylvania in 1987, they created a Distressed Cities or Counties or Borough Act. It's called Act 47. And what it does is it empowers the Department of Community and Economic Development to declare these municipalities as financially distressed. Then they're able to provide restructuring of financing of the distressed municipalities. But the problem is they cannot obtain government funding for it. And what they try to do is to get these distressed communities to merge with other municipalities, which no one wants them because it'd be taking on a huge debt of the distressed city. So what I found in Beaver Valley was that we have distressed cities, as well as many of them that are verging on being what they call Act 47. They're very close to being listed as distressed cities in Pennsylvania. Right now in Pennsylvania, there's actually 20 distressed cities that have been distressed economically since 1987. They've never been able to pull out of that. They cannot any longer get government funds to help them as they were in the past, so they become more and more distressed. There's no way of finding a way out for them.
And how did that distress condition show up? Were these failing communities or economically failing communities, industries that went defunct, or was there a particular time period that that they were failing?
My area, a lot of the distress was caused by industry leaving. A lot of it was taken overseas by NAFTA, CAFTA, whatever the different groups were. And in my area alone, we had a mill, a steel mill, that was right around 10 miles long that was totally taken down, removed from the area, and taken overseas to be built and used over there. This put thousands of people out of work. The one mill itself hired, I think it was somewhere around 12,000 to 15,000 people. When it was gone, whole cities collapsed. Some of the ones that had branch sites like Bethlehem Steel in eastern Pennsylvania were able to maintain their retirement funds. Other ones, they just closed the mill and shut down all the retirement funds. They took the money and ran, basically. In my area, we've gone from a population of 180,000 in the county. Now we're probably hovering right around 120,000.
And so the state, because of this financial distress, has removed from the local governments the means for leveraging or generating more credit for their operation and growth. And they're basically in the hands of bureaucrats as opposed to local interests.
Yeah, what they're hoping to do is get each of the counties to be able to bail out these distressed communities. And these distressed communities, because of lack of tax base that they once had, are darn near impossible to bail out of that condition. And since they are listed as high risk, bonding or financing to help those distressed areas is impossible.
What prospect does the public banking idea have in that situation?
Well, we have in western Pennsylvania, not only do we have the ability of counties to create their own economic development bank that would benefit the taxpayer and the county and all the boroughs and townships in the area, but we also have the ability to create a 10-county regional economic development bank. This is an existing economic development entity that looks for any way to create work within the 10 counties. If they would create an economic development bank over 10 counties, the bank could be created with a lot less funds if each county shared, and they could specialize just in the distressed neighborhoods to get them back. This would save many, many areas in western Pennsylvania. It would get them off the distressed list.
And presumably this is a situation all across America, in many other cities and states as well. So it's a very creative sort of adaptation to a really unfortunate, really tragic sort of economic development. How has the reception been among the various political leaders in that area to this thought?
I went out of Beaver County after I realized it's going to be very difficult here to create an economic development bank, and I focused on Pittsburgh, mainly because we have a new mayor up there, and the guy is fantastic. I mean, he goes around to the communities and sees what he can do for the communities. He has actually written articles in different papers and journals talking about a new economy that he wants to create. We can no longer live with what we've done before. It's not working for us. We have to change our approach of doing things. He also mentioned the idea that we need funding for infrastructure problems that we have in Pittsburgh. The systems around here are around 100 years old or maybe more in some of these older towns, and it's costing the cities and counties more and more and more every year to be able to repair these lines. I presented the public banking idea to the mayor of Pittsburgh with the idea that they could finance these at very low interest and keep the interest accrued from the financing of these projects within the city itself, and to be able to reuse that fund over and over and over again to help its communities and the taxpayers in the region.
And having a local public bank would allow them to create some of their own credit and their own bonding initiatives.
Not only that, it would be perpetual. Even school construction, in my area, they're building a new school addition for $11.7 million. In the time it takes to pay off that loan, it's going to be right around 30-year bond. They're going to be paying right around $60,000 a month for 30 years. They're going to be paying in interest alone over $9 million. If the county would have had a taxpayer-owned economic development bank, that interest could have been reduced by about $6 million very easily.
That's really quite a story, John, and you're describing a scenario I know that is not singular to western Pennsylvania and Pittsburgh. Is there a website that people can visit to find out more about what's going on with the Pennsylvania Project?
Yes, Walt, it's publicbankingpa.org.
All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, John, and best of luck to you with your efforts there. It certainly sounds like a very exciting frontier and a very important one as well.
Thank you, Walt.
That was John Leonard of the Pennsylvania Public Bank Project. Well, that will do it for this edition of It's Our Money. Our thanks today to Mark Pasch of the Center for Progressive Economics, Mike Krause of the Public Banking Institute, and John Leonard of the Pennsylvania Project, and to Wallaby Studios in Philadelphia. You can read Ellen's latest work and follow her timely commentary on her Web of Debt blog at ellenbrown.com. And you can hear podcasts of this show at prn.fm.
On behalf of Ellen Brown, I'm Walt McCree. See you next time.